on the record.
On the record.
It's November the 12th, 2010. It's 10 a.m. We are on the record. This is Charles Chandler, presiding officer in the FRM hearings, called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State, William Gardner, by order dated October 5th, 2010. We are here today to take testimony on the record under oath. But first, I'm going to ask Attorneys Forcier and Spill if there are any preliminary matters from the Bureau this morning.
No, sir.
Okay. With that, I'm going to recognize our first two witnesses, Stephen Watkins and Michelle Watkins. You, in fact, are Stephen Watkins and Michelle Watkins. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you willing to testify under oath this morning?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Then I'm going to swear both of you. Do each of you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. and Mrs. Watkins, over the last few weeks, we've heard from many individuals. Many of the individuals have had prepared statements and have asked to read them in the record at the beginning of their testimony. Others have not had prepared statements but wish nevertheless to give an opening statement. I note from your file that there is a prepared statement. Would you like to read that into the record?
Yes, sir, I would.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to proceed then.
In first place, I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to share some of our concerns and personal story resulting from our losses in the FRM, CLN, and financial fraud. My wife and I minister in a small rural community. Our church is too small to afford a pastor's pension, and we've always saved diligently in preparation for retirement. We have not only lived within our means, but very often lived below our means because we understood the significance of saving. And so you can't imagine the sense of loss at the realization our whole life savings that we worked over 30 years to save is gone. At 56 years old, I am faced now with the stark reality of starting all over again. Make no mistake, we consider ourselves fortunate compared to many of our fellow lenders in that we are still of working age and we still have an income. Others have lost their homes, some have been forced into bankruptcy, disabled people have lost their sole source of income, older people have been forced out of retirement into menial jobs just to support themselves, and there have been several suicides reported as a result of the fraud perpetrated against us. But it adds further insult to injury knowing that several New Hampshire state officials and agencies had ample opportunity to shut FRM down before our money was jeopardized and yet neglected to do so. From the beginning, this story has been about almost everyone except the people who should be its focus. Will Governor Lynch be reelected? Will Kelly Ayotte go to the Senate? What did Peter Hildreth know and when did he know it? But for those of us who have experienced this life-altering loss, this story is much more tragic than the fate of a few politicians. It's not only about financial loss and future insecurity. It's about the injustice that we continue to experience at the hands of a legal system that should be helping us rather than causing further injury. My wife and I were shocked to see our names listed as defendants in an adversarial hearing brought against us by the Chapter 7 trustee of the bankrupt company, Stephen Nottinger, when he filed that first preliminary injunction dated December 17th and 21st of 2009. Why is the government's trustee our adversary rather than our advocate? In my limited understanding of the laws pertaining to involuntary bankruptcy, the provision to appoint a trustee is to protect the assets for the creditors until the legal matters are sorted out. Yet Mr. Nottinger's wife and partner, Deborah Nottinger, was quoted in several news outlets as saying, "Our mandate is to liquidate, not help the investors." Several times a week, we receive yet another legal notice informing us of yet another motion brought by the trustee. And while I realize that this is a very complex matter and legal motions must be written in legal language, I also realize that Mr. Nottinger's task is difficult. However, most lenders involved with FRM are working class citizens and not lawyers, and we are struggling to understand this process. As a result, we have been forced to spend what little money we have left hiring attorneys to defend ourselves against the government's representative because we believe he is trying to seize our assets. I hope that is not the case, but as far as I can tell, Mr. Nottinger has done very little to dispel that perception. The preliminary injunction from December 17 and 21 of 2009 on page 4, Article 1, which I've provided a short excerpt from, and I quote, "All descendants and defendants in this matter, including without limitation, all John Doe defendants who are served with a copy of this order, collectively as the enjoined parties, are hereby enjoined from spending, transferring, or otherwise dissipating any payments, instruments, property, proceeds, funds, and or accounts in their possession or control on the date such party is served with this order," end quote. We made several attempts to get clarification from Trustee Nottinger's office regarding this order, but never received it, despite their personal assurances otherwise. At the close of James Donch's cover letter accompanying that preliminary injunction, he states, "If you have any questions regarding the requirements of the order, please call Trustee Stephen Nottinger or Attorney James Donch's," end quote. We have called, we have emailed, we have left messages, and we have been ignored. Our attempts to contact the trustee's office for clarification on specific issues, despite his personal commitment to keep us informed and communicate with us during that first conference call that he hosted for the lenders when he was first appointed trustee, have mostly been disregarded. For almost a year now, that injunction has been hanging over our heads. What does it mean that we are enjoined from spending, transferring, or otherwise dissipating any payments? Does that apply to our personal bank accounts where we have deposited the interest we earned over the past several years? For example, I've been seeing a specialist this year that my medical insurance doesn't cover. Will I be held liable for that money I've had to spend on medical expenses? How about mortgage payments? Does Mr. Nottinger intend to eventually sue us? These are very real fears that persist because there has been almost no positive communication from his office. My intent is not to villainize him, but our impression of Mr. Nottinger's actions is that his ultimate goal is to garner as many of our assets that we paid for to ensure his legal fees continue to increase. In the meantime, lenders without the means to defend themselves are left at the mercy of a legal system that should protect crime victims, not punish them. We deserve to know that we are being treated fairly and honestly. And where is the state government in all this? If the matter before us is how state officials could have permitted a disaster of this magnitude to evolve for a decade, why hasn't the state taken a more active role in helping the victims? Why hasn't someone in an official capacity been assigned to look out for our interests? Despite repeated failures on the part of state agencies and their officials, there has been no effort to limit or remediate the damages done to us. If the purpose of these hearings is, in fact, to see what can be done to prevent a disaster like this in the future, a great place to begin would be the establishment of an advocacy process that helps victims rather than leave them with the fear of being victimized all over again. Mr. Nottinger's fundamental argument is that since FRM and CL&M commingled our monies, it is impossible to determine which assets belong to which lender. Except we have settlement documents filed in courthouses with appropriate title searches and secured by title insurance, telling us exactly which real estate or project our money was intended to fund, along with monthly statements telling us exactly which loans our interest payments came from. Lenders I have communicated with question why the government has not more thoroughly investigated other players in this fraud. As the investigation unfolded, it became obvious that FRM could not have perpetrated a scam of this magnitude without the knowledge and cooperation of other professionals, appraisers that deliberately overvalued property, straw borrowers that have signed their names to projects that were only partially or never developed at all, and attorneys that executed mortgage closings and performed title searches. An article by Gail Ober in the Laconia Citizen dated February 10, 2010 describes a lawsuit brought by lenders focusing on some of the developers, lawyers, and appraisers who allegedly worked with the principals, end quote. The article documents several individuals accused of purporting to borrow money for specific projects, but never used or even received any of the proceeds for their intended purpose. The conclusion of the attorney representing the lenders is that it appears the borrower was a straw. Ms. Ober's article also cites an appraiser that provided unreasonable and improperly inflated values of real estate that served as collateral on many of the loans. And so the question is why individual lenders have to assume the expense and responsibility to bring civil suits against those involved with aiding FRM when it is clearly the government's responsibility to enforce the law. Why won't the government help us make claims for title insurance that we paid for? Then there is the role of Gould and Burke, who not only shared offices with FRM, but processed the vast majority of their closing documents. They most certainly had to know something was amiss as they processed millions of dollars of loan closings on overvalued and oversold projects. For example, Tangway Homes Abbott Village was worth between $6 and $8 million at the height of its value, according to news sources. And yet, according to those sources, FRM wrote $25 million worth of mortgages against it. Shouldn't someone at Gould & Burke at some point have asked, didn't we just process several million dollars on that same project last week? Rather than profit from the situation, common ethical standards demand that they should have drawn attention to it and reported it. Those attorneys are every bit as complicit as if they had driven the getaway car in a bank robbery. As lenders, we are well aware that professionals are required to carry liability and malpractice insurance, and yet the AG's office seems content to allow them to slip quietly into the shadows while the injured parties of these crimes are left to their own resources. Why isn't the liability insurance of these collaborative professionals being pursued as possible sources of restitution by Mr. Nottinger? Most people injured in this scam have lost their entire life savings and are completely at the mercy of the legal system. Every time I receive another court order or notification with my name in the defendant's column, I ask myself how I became a defendant when I am the one who was robbed. It's the nightmare we can't wake up from. Mark Connolly's resignation statement accurately describes this crime as financial violence, and that is exactly how it feels, as if our lives were torn apart. Someone needs to stick up for us. Someone needs to say, enough is enough. Someone needs to help us, not victimize us all over again. It doesn't require a law degree to know the difference between right and wrong. Once again, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to tell just a small part of what has been a very tragic and painful story for a lot of people.
Thank you very much for your statement. In addition to the statement provided to the Bureau, you've also provided a substantial number of documents relative to transactions, and I'd like to review some of those documents with you in a general sense, and a few of them in some detail. But before we get into the specific transactions where you were a lender. Could you tell me how you came to be aware of FRM and CLNM?
We were, like everyone else, we were taking a beating on our IRAs, and so I initiated a search. I was particularly interested in investing in real estate and something substantial rather than, you know, the market. And, you know, that's when I stumbled across this whole idea of these hard money loans and things. I am not exactly sure of the details. We came into possession of those, the mailers, the lending opportunities that that FRM was sending out, you know, with the different things. And so in 2006, we rolled our IRA accounts over into the Pensco company and made our first couple of purchases in that way.
Did you ever receive any postcards in the mail from FRM entitled Opportunities?
I don't remember postcards.
Okay. But you do recall receiving detailed information packages,
yes,
about particular projects. Is that correct?
Yes. Frequently.
And how were those delivered to you?
Through the mail.
Okay. And how did it come to pass that you became a person to receive those documents?
That's the question. I'm sure I was the one who initiated that call. I'm sure I talked to Scott Farah first.
Is it fair to say that your recollection is that a result of that call, these information packages on opportunities then came to you?
Probably, yes.
And if you saw one of these packages that enticed you, what would you do then?
Well, we made our first two investments and just sort of let them ride for a year. We, you know, were very interested in making sure that the closing documents were legitimate. You know, that these things seemed to be backed up with title insurance and those kinds of things, and so you know, we let it we let this thing go for a whole year. You know, we received our interest payments every month, and so it was at that point then we decided to purchase another loan.
You've used the word investment twice here. At any point in time throughout your entire dealings with FRM or CLNM, did you feel that monies you were forwarding to them was in any way creating an interest in either of those entities?
No, absolutely not.
Were you, in fact, lending money for a particular project?
Yes.
And what was the role in that lending process of FRM?
Well, we have purchased two homes in our life, and in both of those instances, we had real estate agents that represented us. So I guess in my mind, you know, and also in those cases, the real estate agent provided the attorneys that closed the documents. So in my mind, FRM represented the role that a real estate broker would have fulfilled in a normal, you know, if we were buying a home to take possession of or to live in.
But is it fair to say that your testimony this morning is that at no time were you lending money to FRM?
That's correct.
Is it also fair to say that at no time were you lending money to CLNM?
That's correct.
Did you even know what CLNM was?
Yes, we were explained. I mean, it was explained to us that CLNM would be handling the distribution of the.
Do you remember recall hearing the word as servicing?
We do have documents describing them as a servicing, as a loan servicer. Yes, called a loan servicing. agreement.
On June 23rd of 2009, there was a letter mailed to you indicating that CLNM was holding a deposit of $50,000 for lending on Kissimmee, Florida transaction.
That's correct.
Okay. Can you explain to me what your understanding was of that transaction?
Once again, this was presented to us as a construction project that was going to be that was going to house commercial offices, and so we were told that we would be it would be like, you know, it would be like the other things that we had purchased, that this would be in fact a part of a trust that held the mortgage on this office building.
If I were to characterize that as a loan for partial funding of a real estate project, would that be a fair characterization?
Yes.
You weren't the sole financier of that loan, is that correct?
That's correct.
It's fair to say you received a percentage interest in that trust for your $50,000?
Yes.
Did you believe that as a participant in that loan process, that if there was a breach of the mortgage, you would have a right, along with others, to foreclose on that real estate?
Absolutely, yes.
Is it fair to say then that you believed your funds were secured by real estate?
Absolutely.
So when you use the word investment, you're saying you lent, that means to you the lending of money that is secured by real estate.
That's correct.
Okay. It isn't as if you gave money to FRM or CLNM to fund the operation of either of those entities. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We need to be absolutely clear about that.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I note later on in the information that you've supplied to the Bureau that there was a loan here in New Hampshire regarding Tangway Homes LLC unit 31-4 on Callaway Drive. And if you'll bear with me, I turned right to it. And I'm looking at a document entitled Attachment A, called Loan Servicing Agreement.
Yes.
Says the amount of this loan is $46,500.
Yes, sir.
The lender's name is Michelle Watkins and or Pensco Trust Company for benefit of Michelle Watkins IRA. It indicates in a highlighted rectangle that the lender's ownership interest was 100%. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And Ms. Watkins, is that a correct characterization that in this particular instance you were viewed as the lender?
Yes.
Okay. Did you believe in that instance that you and you alone would possess a right to foreclose on real estate if there was a breach of mortgage covenants?
Absolutely.
Okay. No question in your mind?
No.
That was the only reason we made these purchases.
Did you do any transactions with FRM and or CLNM that in your mind was not to be secured by real estate?
No.
Every transaction you made, by your testimony this morning, was to be secured by a mortgage instrument.
Yes.
Transactions in New Hampshire?
Yes.
Transactions outside of New Hampshire?
Yes.
Did you have other transactions other than the Florida transaction that was not in the state of New Hampshire?
Yes. We had one with an individual named Robert Barnett.
Is that in Norton, Massachusetts?
No, that is in
Atlanta.
DeKalb County, Georgia.
Bear with me while I find that transaction. I have it. In that transaction, it appears that the lender was Stephen and Michelle Watkins and that your lender amount was $150,000.
That's correct.
Did you have legal counsel in Georgia?
No. Again, we depended on FRM to supply that, in the same way that the other transactions had taken place, and we assumed that it would operate or function the same way that a real estate agent would bring their own attorney to the table to represent a purchaser. Now, I did talk to Mr. McManus down there who processed that mortgage and also supplied the title insurance, and he was uncooperative, to say the least.
What do you mean by that?
Wouldn't discuss the circumstances or the disposition of that file or even the current disposition of the property down there.
When did this conversation take place?
I'm going to say earlier this summer. If I had to guess, I would say sometime around August, maybe.
Clearly after the closure of FRM.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So after the closure of FRM, you contacted Mr. McManus. Is it fair to say you contacted him because he was the attorney who issued title insurance that you believed represented insurance on property in which you had a security interest?
That's correct.
I note in that transaction in Georgia, your lender's ownership percentage is 9.3750%. This is a $1,600,000 loan. Understanding that you had less than a 10% interest, you believe from the is it fair to say that you believe from the structure of that loan that you possess, nevertheless, a right to foreclose for breach of mortgage covenants?
That's correct.
Okay.
And when I discussed it, because there was a period of that previous summer, there was a period of a couple of months where the payment from that particular loan did not come, and at which time I talked to Scott Farah and asked him, what's the problem here? And he told me Mr. Barnett was having some problems, and I said, okay, well, what are we going to do now? What is the thing? He said, well, if he doesn't get squared away, we will foreclose on him. That was in fact the term that he used.
There's no doubt in your mind that you had that conversation with Scott Farah.
No.
There's no doubt in your mind that he used the word foreclose.
Yes.
And that would have been the summer of, by your testimony, 2009, prior to the closure of FRM. Is that correct?
Yes, because, well,
it was summer of 2009.
When wasn't that? We were on the paper scene.
Yes, August, or July of 2009.
Yes, that would have been in July of 2009.
Okay. Is it also fair to say that you participated in a loan for a condominium in Belfast, Maine?
Yes.
And in this case, it was a participation by you to 25.31645557%. And the amount you lent was $100,000, is that correct?
That's correct.
This is going to seem repetitive, but this is very important to me. That main loan, is there any doubt in your mind that your 25%+ interest in that loan was secured by a mortgage on real estate?
No, there was no doubt.
So that if there were a breach of covenants of the mortgage of real estate, you would have a right to foreclose?
That's correct.
You had no question in your mind about that?
Absolutely not.
I note that you have referred to title insurance policies.
Yes.
Did you review the title insurance policies that came to you relative to these out-of-state loans that you made?
We did not. Not on the out-of-state loan, no. No. Yes. I mean, when we originally got you have to understand, when we get this file is, not even a quarter the size of the file that we got. You know, so we had hundreds of pages on each loan, and so we would go through the master, I don't know if it's called the HUD sheet, where they check off the box of every document that's in like a document transfer memo like this.
I'm aware of that. Yep.
Okay, and so we have one, for example, here from the law office of Gould and Burke. And where they check off all of the things that are included in this, and one of these is a title policy mechanics lien affidavit.
If I may interrupt, I believe, is it fair to say that you are not looking at a HUD form, but you are looking at an internal checklist by the Gould & Burke law firm that they have created for closings?
That's correct.
Okay, just so we're clear.
Yes.
I'd now like to look at some of the transactions in New Hampshire.
Can we just go back to that one?
Oh, absolutely.
Just 1 second. That settlement statement, if you look over the settlement statements, there is always a charge on this loan that I'm looking at, for example. It says title insurance, to First American Title, $691.25. So we believe that we were paying and receiving title insurance. You know, in other words, if we paid for it, we believe that we received it.
And
I don't believe we ever received an official copy of the policy.
Okay.
I think that might have been your original question.
Did you ever receive, so is it fair to say you never received a copy of the lender's title insurance policy on the out-of-state transactions?
No, we never did.
Did you ever receive a copy of a lender's policy on New Hampshire transactions?
Yes, we did.
Okay. The Tangway Homes LLC Unit 34-1, where you had 100% interest, did you get an actual policy?
Deed of trust to roll over my IRA. Insurance, no.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm sorry. Let me check that documentation. No, the only thing I have is listed on page 2 of the HUD settlement statement, lists Old Republic Title Insurance Company, but I do not have backup documentation.
How did you become involved with Penco Trust Company?
That was the instrument that FRM recommended to us. So that was the established instrument that he had in order to legally use IRA funds in order to purchase these mortgages.
So you're having is it fair to say was that characterized as a self-funded IRA by somebody?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Self-directed.
Self-directed. Are you familiar with the law firm of Gould & Burke?
Yes, we are.
How is it that you are familiar with them?
Well, because they are the attorney of record on, I think, all of our mortgage closings except for the one in Georgia and except for the one in Kissimmee, which never closed. Did they close? Don't pass.
Well, your response to that question is taking me to a later question. I might as well ask it now. Are there transactions among your loan dealings with FRM that never closed?
Yes.
And what are those?
We have the one loan that we originally discussed, the Kissimmee, Florida loan. We were told that was a loan that we didn't get interest payments on initially. When I called to find out why, we were told it was because there was not a big enough pool of funding yet to close that project out, and so they were waiting for more funds to come in. But once I made that call, then our interest payments started coming. So I think we only received interest on that for 3 months. Yeah, and we have an apology letter here dated September 10th, 2009.
September 10th, 2009?
Yes. If you need a copy of that.
I probably have it. Even though the Kissimmee, Florida transaction never closed, was it your belief and anticipation in starting the relationship with FRM on this Florida transaction that it would be secured by mortgage on real estate?
Yes.
Okay. Back to the Gould & Burke question. Did you at any time feel that Gould & Burke were representing you as your attorneys in these transactions?
Yes. I think in as much as, you know, we got the documentation that demonstrated that they were being paid from at least some of the funding that we provided, certainly I would have assumed that they were representing my interests at that point.
Did you ever attend closings for these transactions?
No, we didn't. No.
Stay with me. I have nothing further at the moment. Attorney Spill, do you have anything?
I just have a few questions.
Sure.
Thank you. I understand you came a long way today to be with us, and thank you for putting in the effort. With respect to the money that was meant for these loans, did you make out checks to CLNF?
Yes.
And were those checks sent to CLNF?
Yes.
Is it fair to say then that you entrusted CLNM with that money for those real estate closings?
Yes, absolutely.
And that money was meant for the borrowers designated on the loans that you were involved with?
Yes.
With respect to the interest that you received on the loans, in all cases, was the interest paid at the time of closing forward or at the time you sent the money forward?
generally, I'm going to say at the time we sent the money.
I would say, with exception to the final loan, the Kissimmee loan, that they said enough funds had not come in yet. We had to call them because we had not received any payments, and then they sent us an apology letter with the interest.
And when was the first loan that you got involved with?
That was to Tangway Homes in... Oh, that's right. No, I'm sorry. That's correct. We had a loan. My IRA was initially invested with a Lawrence Baldy project in Meredith at Camellia Avenue.
Corliss Hill.
I'm sorry. You're right. At Corliss Hill Road in Meredith. That initial purchase was then rolled. I think Mr. Farah contacted us and told us that loan had closed. And especially since it was an IRA, I said, fine, go ahead and let's put it in another project. I think he was the one who chose the Tangway Homes project. That was the very first purchase that we made. And so including interest, that original $29,000 IRA was in the amount of $32,000.
Are you talking about the Tangway Homes loan?
Yes.
We have a record of two.
Yes.
One was 34-1 Callaway Drive, and the other one was 1-4 Camellia Ave.
Right.
That's correct.
Was Callaway Drive the first one?
No. Camellia Avenue was the first on September 12, 2006.
The documentation shows the date of the note, February 21, 2007, for $52,000.
For the Tangway. Not sure what documentation you're looking at. I have under loan five.
We have two transactions, and I'm looking at this cover sheet.
Oh, the cover sheet.
And one says 34-1 Callaway Drive, and the other one says 1-4 Camellia Ave. One was for $46,500, the other one was for $52,000.
Yes, because my attachment A, loan servicing agreement for the $46,500, my date of the note that I have is October 3rd, 2006.
Okay, so that would have been the first Tangway one?
That would have been actually the second Tangway. The first one was the smaller one for $32,000 at Camellia Ave.
But you're right, that does say February 22nd, 2007.
It says $52,000 on our document.
Yes, you're right, I have that. And that really confuses me. Oh, if you look down into this lower box, it shows our lender amount.
Could you tell me what document you're referring to?
I'm sorry, okay, we're on attachment A, loan servicing agreement on Tangway Homes, Camellia Avenue.
It's the last group here, by the way.
Thank you.
It shows our lender's dollar amount is $32,000.
Oh, the total loan amount is
with the total loan amount, so we were only 61% ownership.
With respect to the, I guess you're saying that the one on Callaway Drive was the second one? The 46-5?
Yes.
It says on the cover sheet, unit 34-1, Callaway Drive, and then the letter says 34-1, TaylorMade Ave. Do you see that? October 18, 2006.
It's a letter right behind the cover sheet.
A letter dated October 18, 2006 from Diane M. Smith to Michelle Watkins.
Right. It appears to have a different address.
We have October 18, 2006.
Right.
That's.
I see TaylorMade Avenue.
You're right.
Lot 34-1. I have never noticed that.
So is that letter inaccurate?
It's unit 34-1 on my loan servicing. So the only thing that remains the same is the 34/1. But you're right, one says TaylorMade Avenue, the other says Callaway Drive. And I was not aware of that, so.
But the actual loan was for Callaway and not TaylorMade.
It was.
And on this particular loan, let's go back to Camellia Ave, unit 1-4. You said that was the first one, right?
Yeah, well, he started it out with a loan on 5 Corliss Hill Road.
Excuse me, when you say he...
Mr. Farah, sorry.
You.
Mr. Farah started it out with a Lawrence Baldy loan for Steve's IRA, and the date I'm showing is 8/16/2006 for Corliss Hill Road. But then in September, 1 month later, he switched it over to Tangway Homes, Camellia Avenue.
Is that address on the, it says borrower loan information. I mean, is that date, February 21, 2007, accurate, or is that a mistake?
I am not sure. I would have to actually look through my full file if I could, if that's something I could present to you later. I don't know why those dates are. The original letter we have from CL&M is September 15, 2006, telling us about the number 5 Corliss Hill Road. But I don't have...
Let's look at the settlement statement for August 16, 2006. It appears as though it's the lot 5 Corliss Hill Road.
Okay, yeah, Lot 5 Corliss Hill Road, that was the Meredith property that Lawrence Baldy was listed as the borrower in. But that was the one that was very quickly rolled over to the Tangway Homes, Camellia Avenue property.
Do you know why?
We really don't, no. That's one of those mysteries. I think at the time it was explained to us that that the Baldy loan had either closed or he just felt like this was a better project. I honestly don't remember the details of that.
In looking at the settlement statement, It doesn't appear as though there was any prepaid interest given at the closing. Is that accurate?
No, there was no prepaid interest that I know of.
Did you receive any monthly interest checks on the Corliss Hill property?
Yes, I think we did. Yes, we got $3,458.
Okay. Would you know when in the progression of events that it was switched over to Penguin?
Let's see, according to this, it would have been September 15th to 2000.
Here's Camellia right here.
Okay,
what document are you referring to?
Attachment A, loan servicing agreement, when he switched, when I believe this was Don Dodge or Scott Farah, switched it over to Camellia Avenue. That is dated February 21st, 2007. And I don't know how that came about. The dates are very confusing on this loan.
And I'm looking at the settlement statement for Calgary Drive,
34-1.
That settled, it appears as though, in October of 06. That also appears not to have any prepaid interest on it, in that settlement. Is that accurate?
Correct.
When you say prepaid interest, you mean interest coming to us?
Yes.
In like in escrow or something?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm just trying to get clarification on that. Looking at these transactions, is it fair to say that on some there was prepaid interest, but some there were not?
No.
The only thing I would say was prepaid was our final loan in Kissimmee, Florida. We had to call to get interest because they hadn't paid them. But we had no closing papers on that one. But all the others that went to closing, then the interest came after.
Well, if we look at the settlement statement for Shipmaster LLC. This data note May of 08. You see that?
Yeah.
It says 12-month interest reserve, CLNME, $51,000.
Yes.
That was interest that was reserved to be paid to you?
He was, the way that interest reserve mechanism was explained to us is that was money that the borrower paid up front in order to secure the loan. In the event that they didn't make their payments, that money would then cover our interest.
Okay. Now, referring back to the other two settlement statements that we discussed, is it fair to say that's not on there, the prepaid interest, with respect to Tangway?
Oh, with respect to Tangway.
We just looked at them.
Okay.
We did not receive settlement statements on those two.
Tangway. Oh, we didn't.
I don't. We just, because they were IRAs, we signed what they called deed of trust and filled that out. But there's not like a HUD settlement statement.
That's right. The PENSCO documentation is even different.
We have an IRA application and rollover.
I believe we got these from you.
Yes.
Okay, so you do have them. I'm sorry.
We do have a settlement statement. That's correct.
Do you notice that the 12-month prepaid interest doesn't appear?
Yes, I do notice that.
Now, are you saying despite what the document says, you did in fact receive interest before the loan closed?
Only on Kissimmee.
Yeah, no, only on Kissimmee. I don't think we received interest until these transactions closed.
Oh, okay. All right. So
yeah, no,
I was confused. I thought you said the opposite.
Well, Pensco was different, though, because Pensco was IRA money, and so I think that was sort of, I think that was ongoing.
When was the Kissimmee project?
That was in June of 2009.
So very last loan. That's the only loan that we ever received interest prior to closing, and then there never was any. I'm sorry, I think we misunderstood what you were asking.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought it was the other. You were saying it was the other way around.
No, Kissimmee's the only one we received payments or interest, and it never went to closing. All the others went to closing, and then we received monthly.
Okay, I have no further questions.
Mr. Forsey, do you have?
Just one quick question. Did you folks ever receive mortgage instruments that were stamped and recorded? Or, because I noticed that many, if not all, of the mortgage documents are not the actually recorded documents, with a stamp on the top indicating that it was brought down and recorded. Did you ever follow up to find out if any of these documents were in fact recorded?
I think in the aftermath, according to my conversation, especially with Mr. McManus down in Georgia, I did ask him if that had been recorded at the DeKalb County Courthouse, and he said yes, that it was.
Do you have any documentation of any of these recorded ones with the stamps on top that you may not have provided?
It's possible that if they're in our... It's possible.
If you find some that actually have the stamps on it, could you provide it to us after the fact?
Sure.
If you wish to, and we could perhaps enter it after the fact?
Okay.
Could you clarify for me what form it would generally be on?
It'd be the same as the mortgage that we have here in the documents, except there'd be a stamp on top indicating that that paper, those mortgage instruments were brought to be recorded, and it would have been stamped on top. It'd be the exact same thing you have, but a stamp on top.
Okay.
That indicates a day, time, book number, page number, and things like that. If you do discover any of those with the recording stamp on it, if you wouldn't mind, if you could provide it to us, and we could enter it on the record anytime, in the next couple of weeks, that you may or may not find it.
Okay.
Appreciate that. I have no further questions.
I have a few. I'd like to go back to your very first transaction. At the time that transaction, as I understand it, rolled over.
Yes.
Did you sign any authorization for such a rollover?
Yes. The deed of trust and mortgage direction letter was for lot 5 Corliss Road.
Is that dated 8/30/06?
Yes, 8/30/06.
It's signed by you.
That's the date I signed. That's correct.
And how did that document come to be in your possession, if you recall?
They were mailed to us. They were mailed to us at the time.
From whom?
Of the transaction. From CL&M.
Okay.
This one actually is signed by Don Dodge and has his signature, his Guilford address as opposed to the Northview Drive address.
Is it fair to say that you had some kind of a discussion with Scott Farah concerning the rollover of these funds?
Yes.
And as a result of that conversation, you became convinced it was a prudent thing to do. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is it also fair to say that the interest that you earned on the initial loan was all rolled into the sum that was rolled over?
That's correct.
Oh, and
the original purchase was for $29,000, and then the secondary rollover was for $32,000.
When you entered these transactions, these multiple transactions, utilizing FRM, how did you forward the money to them?
We wrote checks.
Personal checks?
We wrote personal checks from our bank savings, yes.
And you mailed it to them?
And I mailed it to CLN.
If you recall, how soon after that mailing did your closing of these transactions occur?
What would you think? Within a month or so?
If you can bear with me, I think I have a copy of the checks that we wrote.
I'm really looking just for a rough idea of the amount of time funds may have been in the hands of CLNM and our FRM prior to any closing.
2 weeks is what I would say.
And I would say within a month. Generally, I would say within a month. It usually, you know, in other words, if we sent them a check, made a purchase in, you know, September, I would say by October, we had received our first interest.
And is it fair to say, based on your testimony responding to Attorney Spill, that the first interest payment did not reflect any earnings for the time period between the time the money was sent and the closing?
No, because very often it was per diem. There was a per diem breakdown on that first check. Yes.
Well, let's revisit that then. So, is it then fair to say that you did receive some compensation for the time frame between the receipt of the check by CLNM and the closing?
I guess so. I mean, I think it depends really on the transaction we're talking about,
okay,
because it wasn't real consistent.
Okay.
Seemed to be, you know, it never seemed to work exactly the same twice.
Okay.
I mean, is that your recollection?
Yeah, I believe if you want that information at a later date so I don't take up your time, I believe I could actually, I have letters usually signed by Diane Smith that says, we received your check on such and such a day, and here's your per diem for the 12 days.
I would ask you then to look for those letters,
okay,
and forward them to the Bureau. I'd be extremely interested in those letters.
Okay.
Did you ever have direct dealings with Donald Dodge?
Yes.
And what were those dealings like? Oh.
Well, if I had an issue, once a deal was initiated, we would deal with it. Like if there was a problem, or if I had a question or something, I would call CLNM directly. And very often, Diane Smith would answer the question if she could. If she couldn't, then she would pass me on to Don, and he would, either explain something to her or call me back or take the call immediately. But yes, there was direct communication with Don Dodge.
Okay. How'd you learn of the failure of FRM?
Probably from one of Al's emails. It didn't take long.
Okay.
It was within a couple of days.
And after you learned of the failure, did you contact any state agencies?
Yes, I spoke with, I'm sorry, that's probably how we discovered it. A guy named Richard Tracy from the AG's office was the first to call me.
As a result of that telephone call, did you call any state agencies?
No, I did not. Well, we spoke with...
There was an assistant to Mr. Tracy. We spoke to him. And he asked for our information. But I wouldn't know the assistant's name.
The only contact we had with a state agency was post-closure. Okay. It was not prior.
I have nothing further. Mr. Spill.
Yes, if you don't mind. Just curious about the, I think you stated that prepaid interest concept was inconsistent. Is it also fair to say that the interest reserve concept was something that was inconsistent, that only occurred on some, not all the loans?
No, I think that was pretty much built right into every contract, because that was something we were highly aware of. You know, that was something we wanted as security.
Because I noticed it doesn't appear on the Tangway deals, on the settlement statement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On the two IRAs.
Right, that's right. And again, it was because the documentation for the Pensco loans was always a little different from the other ones.
So you're saying, despite what the HUD statement says, there was money taken out for an interest reserve, as in Shipmaster?
I think it was presented to us that way. Now, whether there is documentation to that effect, I honestly can't tell you.
Thank you.
Who, if you know, prepared the closing statements for these transactions, at least the ones in New Hampshire?
Gould and Burr.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Nothing
further. Forcia, Mr. Spill. Mr. and Mrs. Watkins, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come here to the state of New Hampshire. It means a great deal to this process. It's a high level of effort on your part to gather the documents to put them together for the Bureau. Your testimony will assist me greatly, I assure you. Just so we recall, we are going to look for some additional documents. Most importantly to me are the letters from either FRM or CLNM indicating what you call per diems. Okay?
I did just find one. So.
Okay. Well, if you could present those to Mr. Forcia, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And thank you. We really appreciate the fact that you guys are making this extra effort and not just... ignoring our plight, and we are appreciative of the process.
Well, you're very welcome, and it's
Mr. Chandler, if I may add, I will have those redacted and provided after the lunch.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's 10:11.
Let's enter those. Mr. Forcia, would you approach, please? Yeah. I'm going to take a 5-minute recess. 5 minutes.
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, have we reconvened? Is it running?
We are currently reconvening.
Okay. The next two witnesses we have are Harry and Priscilla Bean. Welcome to the hearings. You understand that these hearings are, in fact, open and being recorded, and any testimony you give will be under oath.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, do you each solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Okay. You are Harry and Priscilla Bean, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And that Mr. and Mrs. Bean?
Yes.
Mr. and Mrs. Bean, as you may be aware, for the last 2 weeks we've been taking testimony from victims in this matter. And many of the times, those victims have had prepared statements that they wish to read into the record as an introductory remark. Other times, people just wish to give an introductory statement. I noticed from the file you provided to the Bureau that there is a statement. Do you wish to read that into the record?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
We're Harry H. and Priscilla M., being from Guilford. Our family, which includes my parents, my deceased brother, three sisters, and a son, loaned approximately $3.5 million to opportunities identified by FRM and serviced by CLNM. Our portion of the $3.5 million lost was $1.9 million. We'd like to provide some background, which would explain how we became involved in these companies, and then we would like to provide detailed documentation on some of the transactions that were outstanding at the time of FRM's closing. Priscilla and I got married in 1971 at the ages of 16 and 17. We bought our first duplex in 1972, and over a period of 39 years, we accumulated 22 buildings, which provide 76 units that we rent. These properties are located in Laconia and Guilford, New Hampshire, and Deltona, Florida. About 20 years ago, Home Bank in Laconia, New Hampshire went under and our loans were called, which forced us to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This is how we first met Donald Dodge. He helped us find a lawyer and fill out the necessary paperwork for the bankruptcy. Our loans were restructured and there was a balloon payment due at the end of 5 years. Seeking refinancing, we were introduced to Scott Farah by Don Dodge with the intention of exploring refinancing options. Scott was not able to provide viable options at that time, so we refinanced through local banks. A few years later, we were talking with Don Dodge about looking into refinancing our mortgages at a lower interest rate. Dodge once again put us in touch with Scott Farah to explore our options. Farah found refinancing with various lending institutions at approximately 6% interest. After refinancing some of our properties, Farah asked us if we would be interested in making a short-term loan for 90 days to one of his friends, and he, Farah, would personally guarantee it. The loan of $25,000 was repaid after 120 days with $5,000 interest. Several similar loans were made over a couple of years. Approximately 6 years ago, Farah convinced us that we should refinance the remaining apartment buildings in order to protect ourselves from possible lawsuits. We had accumulated a large amount of equity. We asked how this would work, and he stated that the more you owe on your property, the less chance someone would sue you. We asked what should we do for the extra cash, and he said he could lend it to various opportunities that he brokered. The difference in interest rates between what the opportunities offered and what the conventional financing charged would be our profit of approximately 5%. We checked with the Better Business Bureau, my brother checked with the Banking Commission, and we asked around town about FRM and Farah. No negative information was found. After discussion, we accepted his suggested strategy. Farah arranged conventional financing on our buildings through a bank in California named Imperial Bank, which charged 6.86% on our removed equity of $1.9 million. Each time Farah contacted us about a deal via phone or mailings, we always emphasized that we wanted nothing less than a first mortgage position for me, my wife, as well as my family members. At the time we entered into most of the lending opportunities, I had known Don Dodge for approximately 15 years, Scott Farah for 10 years, and attorney Michael Gould for 30 years. Gould had done real estate and tax work for the Bean family. Gould also worked with my father and brother, Ronnie, on the sale
on the sale of the development rights on 127 acres,
Take your time. Take your time. I fully understand the circumstances. Take your time.
Okay, piece of property owned by my father in the town of Guilford. This money would eventually be loaned out through FRM as well. In late December, early January, we received a letter from the city of Gulf Springs, Texas. We were informed that we were being charged for not keeping our property in good condition. My wife called Texas and asked what this was all about. It turned out that Farah had foreclosed on a deal that we were invested in. We knew he had started proceedings to foreclose, but he neglected to let us know that the property was in fact ours. Our correspondence, according to the individual, was going to Burke and Gould's office until it was returned with no further forwarding address. We made a trip in February to check out our property and to try to clear the penalties. At that time, we hired a real estate agent to keep the property looking good and to sell it. The property was sold at a loss the middle of this year. Farah told us that interest accrued prior to closing was built into the loan amount. Our early investments were paid off with a check, and we then gave it back to Farah to reinvest. But most of our later investments were rolled over into new loans with no money changing hands. The impact my family has caused my husband and I to file bankruptcy. Without the interest payments coming in, we do not have enough income from our apartment house business to make our mortgage. We have never lived outside our means and therefore cannot cut corners enough to make ends meet. We have gone from being comfortable to wondering if we will make enough money to pay our health insurance.
I want to thank you very much for reading that statement. I absolutely understand how difficult it is. Prior to looking at some of the loans, I want to ask a question that is probably not easy to answer. I understand your brother has passed. I also understand that early on in your relationship with FRM, he contacted the banking commission. Is that correct? Can you tell me what it is he told you as a result of his conversation with whomever at the New Hampshire Banking Commission?
All he said was that they said that everything was fine with FRM.
Can you give me an idea when that contact would have occurred?
I think it was in 06.
I'm going to ask you to pause. The answer to that last question is going to be very important to me.
I can't be sure that I'm accurate.
Is there any way we could find some documents that might assist you in giving me an idea when that contact may have been made?
There would be probably no documentation. I can talk to his wife and see if she knows.
Would you?
He told me that it was just prior to his investment. So if by talking to her, I should be able to find out when his investment was and give you...
I'm going to ask you to do that. I'm going to ask you to contact Attorney Jeffrey Spill with that information. And before you leave here today, I'm sure Mr. Spill will provide you with a phone number where he can be reached. I will tell you that's extremely important information to me. Okay, having asked those questions, I note in your opening statement that you listed five loans that you as sample loan documents, Tangway Unit 98, SMM Realty Trust, Northview Drive Trust, Stephen Woodman, and Thomas Roby. Would you like to review those, or would you rather have me just ask questions? Either way you want to do it.
You need to understand that when this thing happened, we were working in Florida, and my son brought all of our paperwork. It was in a file to our attorney, Don Crandallman, and we still don't have much of it back. You know, we don't have any of it back, just this information here.
Okay, let me ask some questions then. Your opening statement's actually very clear. The clarity of it is greatly appreciated. There is no doubt, is it fair to say there is no doubt in your mind that any relationship you had with FRM was going to be a real estate loan secured by a mortgage on real estate?
No doubt.
So that if there was a default in the mortgage covenants, you, either alone or in conjunction with others, would have a right to foreclose on that property.
That's what we're told.
At any time in your relationship with FRM or CLNM, did you think in any way that any portion of the funds that you forwarded or rolled over with them was going to be used for the operation or expenses of either of those entities?
Absolutely not.
Did you think that any of the funds or any portion of the funds was going to be used as an investment in either of those entities?
No, sir.
Were you a participatory lender with other lenders in some projects?
Some of them we were.
Okay. In those projects, did you feel that you had some right to foreclose on the real estate if there was a breach of mortgage covenants?
We were told that we would.
Who told you that?
Farrah.
Okay. Are you familiar with the law firm of Gould & Burke?
Yes.
Okay. And how are you familiar with them?
Well, like I said in the statement, my family's done business with Gould for 35 years now. The old homestead where we live, they kept taxing us for what it could be used as. It's a 127-acre parcel that my grandfather's grandfather bought in 1855. And they kept taxing us for house lots and stuff like that. It's just pasture land. So he would go down and fix the, you know, so that we got current use, I guess is the right terminology.
Was it your understanding that Gould & Burke was representing your interests in these transactions with FRM?
Yes.
Any doubt in your mind about that?
None. That helped make us more comfortable because I've known him for so long.
How did you become aware of what has been characterized as opportunities?
Well, at first it was word of mouth right from Scott Farrah. But then he started sending us these opportunities, investment opportunities, I think is what it was labeled.
And what did that look like when it came to you?
It's a big package. You know, this size paper, only those usually 3/8 of an inch thick.
Multiple documents, is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely.
Contained in those documents, were there any appraisal reports of the real estate?
Not actual appraisal reports, but there was values. So, and it said right on those documents, things like loan to value, because that was what I was more concerned with, was loan to value than the interest rate. Because I know that, you know, if I have to foreclose, if I've got a 50% loan to value, chances are real good I'm going to get all my money back.
What kind of loans to value percentages did you see, if you recall?
Some of them were as low as 25% loan to value. Others were, I think, as high as 80% loan to value. And it seemed like the higher the interest rate, the higher the risk. In most of them.
Do you remember how you were introduced to the Tangway Homes property, unit 9-8, here in Concord?
Well, we were, we always asked Scott's opinion. You know, what do you think we should do? You know, other than the loan to value thing and the fact that we wanted to be in a first position. And he told us about that.
Okay. You always insisted, is it fair to say, you always insisted you were going to be in first position?
Always.
Is it also fair to say that you left these transactions feeling you were adequately secured?
Yes.
Is it fair to say you were you felt that you were adequately secured by a security interest in real property?
Yes.
And you considered yourselves lenders, is that correct?
Yes. Barrett told us how he was going to disperse, how the money was dispersed. He said that it would be just like a construction loan through the bank. He said, you know, the foundation will be put in, I'll send an inspector out, we'll make sure that it's all good, and then they'll be paid. And then when the house or the building is built, you know, framed, we'll send an inspector out, and the framing people will be paid, and so on and so forth. Just exactly like construction loan through a bank.
Did he tell you who this inspector would be?
No. At some point, he told me that Tom Hawley did some of it.
And who's Tom Hawley?
One of his construction people.
Okay. Did he ever mention to you the firm REI?
No.
I'm looking at a transaction that I'm going to characterize as SMM Realty Trust. It's a $430,000 transaction. Were you the sole lender on that transaction, if you recall?
We are.
Okay. That transaction has a document with it entitled Guarantee. Signed by Scott D. Farrar, trustee of the CPI 2009 Realty Trust. If you recall that document, what does that document mean to you?
Yeah. You know, most of these documents we didn't even read when we were dealing with Farrah. We'd known all of them for so long. You know, Dodge for 15 years, Diane Smith for 15. This is when we started doing business. You know, the big thing with the $1.9 million. We'd known Dodge and Diane Smith for 15 years, Mike Gould for 30 years, Scott Farrah for 10 years. You know, one time he gave me a bunch of papers he told me to sign. I said, take me a week to read all those. He says, what, you don't trust me? I said, well, yeah, I guess I do. So I just went ahead and signed them. And I think that happened one other time, and after that I just signed them.
Is it fair to say then that what happened is you developed through your family history a pattern of trust over the years?
For all those years, yes.
How did you learn of the failure of FRM?
Don Dodge called me in Florida.
And what did he say to you?
He was in rough shape. He said, it's all gone. I said, what do you mean it's all gone? He said, the whole thing is all done. Everything's done. And I couldn't even comprehend that. I didn't know what he was talking about. I thought maybe four or five of the loans had crapped out. Not just mine, maybe a bunch of them, you know. And I actually told him, I said, well, you know, when I get back up there, I'll come up and see if I can help you and figure out what's wrong and foreclose on the ones it's got to be and this and that, and we'll fix it. But it wasn't what I thought it was. You know, it was just some places that need to be repaired or whatever, but it was different.
Did you receive interest payments in a timely fashion on the transactions that had closed?
Most of them. I really wasn't as concerned with the interest. I was looking to protect what she and I had built. And as long as there was enough money there to pay that $1.9 million mortgage payment out in California and a few bucks left over, I really didn't care about the rest of it. So we didn't even pay that much attention to it.
Did you actually take interest payments yourself so that you could pay that mortgage?
Yes.
So you didn't roll everything over into project?
No, when we say we rolled over principal.
Okay. But you received interest payments and used those interest payments to fund the mortgage that allows you to raise the capital for the loans you made through FRM. Is that a fair characterization?
That's exactly right.
Okay. I've understood what you've done in that transaction.
Yes, sir.
Who is Stephen Woodman, if you know?
Well, he, I don't know when I found this out, but I guess he's one of the church people that goes to Bob Farrah's church. I think I found that out afterwards. But he was a borrower.
And you lent money to him, is that correct?
Yes, we did.
Through FRM?
Yes.
At any time, did you view FRM as anything other than a broker for your loans?
No.
At any time, did you view CL&M as anything other than a servicing agent?
No.
Who is Thomas W. Roby, if you know?
He was another borrower.
Did Mr. Roby have any kind of a relationship with either Scott Farrah or Donald Dodge that you're aware of?
No. I've heard that he may have had some other dealings with Farrah since the closing of FRM. But before that, I didn't know that.
Okay. I've looked at mortgage documents you provided. I note on them that there is in fact recording information. Did you receive title insurance policies on these loans?
We must have received title insurance. We were informed by Don Crandallmeyer that we did have title insurance on some of them, on some of the loans. You provided to the Bureau a series of documents. I'm looking at the Thomas Robey loan. Can you find copies of two pages entitled Loan Master Report? They were at the end of the documents you provided, the last two pages. You have those, Mrs. Bean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at the bottom of the first page, talks about trust account activity.
Uh-huh.
And the last five payments on the first page and all the payments on the second page are characterized as borrower payment.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, if you know, help me understand what that is?
The interest payment was to us was $700 a month. To be honest, I didn't pay any attention to these reports because they were confusing.
Okay, I understand. But your loan was $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And is it fair to say that those two pages total up the disbursements, and the disbursements total $60,000? If you look at the bottom on the second page.
Yeah, they do.
Okay. And included in that are 12 payments of $700. So do I understand from that then that out of the $60,000 you loaned, 12 payments of $700 each of the money you loaned is being paid back to you for interest?
Yes.
Okay.
On some of the loans that we had with Scott, he had said he was going to try to build into the mortgage 1 year of payments to make sure that we would never lose on an investment, because most of the documents was only supposed to be, or of our loans were supposed to be just for 1 year. So he said by building it in there, it guaranteed you money, it's a win-win situation.
Is it fair to say that he said to you that, well, he introduced you to the idea that you are funding somebody who in 12 months or so was going to refinance and pay you off?
Absolutely.
Okay.
12 to 18 months.
And in that time frame, he was going to protect your interest.
Yes. By building the interest payments into the loan.
Does it now look to you that those interest payments are coming out of the money that you actually forwarded to him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably did.
I have nothing further at this time, either Mr. Forcier or Mr. Spill.
I have some questions.
Mr. Spill.
Thank you for appearing here today. Do you know, did you ever meet Chad Bose?
Yes.
Can you explain that to Mr. Chandler?
Well, we went down to Texas to fix that piece of property because the town was upset with us because it was left in disrepair. And while we were down there, we realized that this Bose, Charles Bose III, I think is what he was called, his office was somewhere near where we were, so we decided we were going to go over there and see if he was there. At that point, I figured there was no such person. The address we had was a suite number, so we were just kind of fooling around. And we went to the street, and there actually was a street, which surprised us. And then the property was, they were suite numbers. That surprised me too. And we went into the one that we had as his, and he was there. And I asked him, I told him who I was and asked him if he knew Scott Farah. He said, yeah. I said, well, that's good. I said, well, maybe we found some of our money. And then he said, no, he hadn't done any dealings with Farah. He knew him for quite a while, but he didn't have any dealings with Farah. And he actually told me that the FBI had been there prior to me getting there and investigated him or whatever they do.
What was the time frame?
Late February, I believe.
Of 2010?
Yes.
Getting back to the so-called interest reserve, did I understand you to say that was for some of the loans, but not all the loans?
The first few, I don't recall seeing that on the paperwork, but then it started appearing on the paperwork, the investment opportunity paperwork.
And do you know what about the time frame was that you started seeing that?
No.
Would it have been sometime between 06 and the time of the collapse?
Oh, absolutely. It was in between there. You know, I mentioned something to you about Dodge earlier. You know, Don Dodge, I've known him for a long, long time. And he's a people person. And he, I don't think, would do anything to anybody knowingly to hurt them. It was about 05. I was talking to him in his office in Guilford, and he'd been telling me, you know, that Farah wanted him to do some stuff for him, some paperwork, you know, making, doing these investment opportunities. You know, Farah would give him specific information, and Dodge would write the rest of the story. You know what I mean? Farah would give him stuff like loan to value and the guy's name and the guy's address, and then Don would put it on a piece of paper. And he was doing a bunch of that. At first he started out, he was doing 1 or 2 days a week in his office in Guilford. And then it got up to 2 or 3 days a week that he was doing this paperwork. And then he told me that he was going to work for Scott full-time. And going to work for Scott full-time, all of a sudden this CLM thing comes about. That's, in my opinion, something that's, it sounded like a title to me, you know, but it's something that Scott came up with, and in the newspapers and things, it looks like this is a business that Dodge started. I don't believe that's the case. I think that this is something that Farah did, and put Dodge into it, because Farah was paying Dodge. It wasn't like Dodge was paying Dodge. It wasn't his own business. Farah was paying. And around the middle of 09, Dodge was losing some weight. You know, we talk about that stuff, us fat guys. And he was losing some weight, and I told him, I said, you know, that's pretty cool. He said, yeah. He said, for the first time in my life, I'm feeling good. Things are going good. And so I'm putting some effort into losing some weight, and I might even get a chance to take a vacation later on. And then a little bit later in the fall, he started being more standoffish. Now, I don't know, but it's my opinion that he probably found out what was going on in late summer, early fall of 09. I think that he got scammed just like I did. Farrow would say, here, sign this. And he'd sign it, not even reading it. That's, I honestly believe that. I think that this thing is probably 90 to 95% Farrow. And at some point, I think Don found out what was going on. And you know, when you're in right up to here, how do you get out? You know, you're right up to your neck. How do you get out of that? Do you go to the cops and say, hey, you know, we're doing all this stupid stuff that's illegal? Or do you just try to hope that you can fix it? I think, and Don told me at the beginning of when I started putting my money in, that his wife, and he had just got a new wife, he had a divorce or something years ago, and his ex-wife had died. And at any rate, he wound up with a new wife, and all of her money that she had had from the whole rest of her life was invested with Farrah. I don't know, I just want you to know that I don't think he is anywhere near the blame that it looks like. You know, you guys are reading the papers, oh, his name is on it. Yeah, his name's on it, but he didn't read it, it's my guess. And he got scammed just like we did.
Mr. and Mrs. Bean, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come forward. I believe, have an appreciation for some of your circumstances. Mrs. Bean, I did ask, relative to the time frame in 06, where Mr. Bean, your brother would have talked to the Banking Commission. I can't stress how significant that is to me.
I made note of it.
Okay. If there's a way to find out, and please communicate with Mr. Spill, if you can, with some degree of precision, find out when that telephone call may have been made.
Probably within a couple of months.
Okay.
That's what I imagine.
The more refined for me, the better.
Okay.
And again, appreciate the level of effort that you have put in and the work you put into producing documents.
I just want to let you know, Al and Sue produced the documents for us. We had no idea how to get started.
Well,
if you need a house bill, if I can do that.
Again, time is it now?
It's 5 minutes till noon.
Okay. We are adjourned until 1. It is, Michelle?
Well, 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
Hurry up.
And Mr. Spill and Mr. Forcier, do you have any preliminary matters?
Yes. Steve and Michelle Watkins, who were here this morning,
yes.
They've added an additional document that they wish to add to their set of documents you asked for, the letter from CLMM.
Yes.
There's additional stuff that they want to add, but for today only, we have this, and they plan on getting in touch with me sometime in the near future for some additional documentation.
Okay.
But before they left, they provided this. We have a copy downstairs. They don't have it with me.
Exhibit number 28.
Okay. And would you just put their name?
That is with the Watkins.
Okay, good, good. Nothing else, Mr. Spill or Mr. Forcey?
No, sir. No,
okay.
Sir.
Then I would call our next witnesses to the stand. That would be Ed and Lee Harding. Are they here?
We will be calling them.
Oh, there's a telephone. Okay. Guess we won't call them to the stand.
This is a cell phone.
Oh.
Hello, this is Hardy.
Mr. Harding, my name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer in a hearing that is being conducted here in the state of New Hampshire pursuant to an order of the New Hampshire Secretary of State regarding the FRM matter, so-called. Are you aware that you are on a speakerphone in a duly convened hearing and that if you choose to testify, your testimony will be under oath?
I am.
Okay. Am I also aware that your wife may testify?
She's here with me. She wasn't planning on it, but if you would like her to, she can.
Well, no, that's entirely up to you. The reason I ask that is that I am going to administer an oath to whomever wishes to testify, and with that, I will do that. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
And Mrs. Harding, if you wish to testify, I'm going to ask you to respond to that oath.
She can't hear you, so...
Okay, well then I'm going to confine the testimony to you then, Mr. Harding. Is that acceptable?
That should be fine.
Okay. Mr. Harding, for 2 weeks now, this hearing has been listening to victims of this FRM matter. And when people testify, many of them have prepared written statements that they read into the record prior to questioning from me or from the attorneys from the Bureau of Securities Regulation. Or, in the alternative, they make an opening statement without preparation. Do you have a prepared statement?
I do.
Would you care to read that into the record?
Yes, I would. And in fact, let me also say that I'm working with a hands-free cell phone here, so that if I need to shuffle through papers later, I could do it more easily. If that ever becomes an issue, let me know, and we can switch over to the landline home phone.
Okay. Please proceed with your opening statement, Mr. Harding.
Sure. Mr. Chandler, thank you for your choice to take on this morass as a civic duty, although I would be surprised if some of your family members have questioned the state of your mental health for doing so. But as one sitting on the other end of the table and testifying now, and having listened to the hearings and having worked through the preparation for today, I'm still looking for several words above commendable to express my appreciation for the civility and respect with which you, Mr. Still, Mr. Wingate, Mr. Forcier, have, and many behind-the-scenes people too, I think, have conducted yourselves in this process. These qualities have been all too rare from other quarters since last November. We are, my wife is Lee Harding, I'm Ed Harding, and our daughter's name is Amy, who live in New Jersey. We became involved in private mortgage lending in 2003. We were doing this in the southeastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey markets. In 2007, after getting a number of promotional postcards from FRM, we did some research on the firm. We made phone calls, we did internet research, we used library resources, we called the New Hampshire Better Business Bureau, and we talked with three other existing lenders who were offered as references. Two of those three said that they had brought other family members into the FRM, CLMM lending world. And I thought that perhaps as a way of adding another layer of due diligence in case any of the initial references was a planted shill, it might be worth talking to these additional family members, and so we did in both cases. Those conversations were very comfortable, and the people seemed very sincere and legitimate. It was a confidence builder, for sure. In general, we could find no causes for concern, and we came across no red flags. So we were now on the FRM's mailing list, and we began receiving the mailing of lending opportunities that had been described earlier in the hearings. Now, you'll find a two-page summary of our FRM loans with the documentation that we have provided. You'll see that we made our first private mortgage lending agreement through FRM in July of 2007. This was for the purchase of land in Haverhill, Massachusetts, and the construction of a duplex-style condo. Our part of this $261,000 project was $132,000. This included money from our savings and funds from both my self-directed IRA and from my wife's self-directed IRA, both through Pensco Trust. This continued along for 15 months and went very smoothly. We and our IRAs received monthly interest payments on time and along with a loan master report each month showing the incremental disbursements to the borrowers. Quarterly, this would also include a set of photographs for the project inspector showing progress on the project. So at the 15-month point, after updated research and new contact with other lenders and still having no red flags and no causes for concern, we decided we would make an additional investment. We felt the fact that we were further diversifying through a variety of borrowers. The second investment was $85,000 in Earth Protection Systems, also known as the 2008 CPR Trust, in October 2008. I spoke with Mr. Kleiner of EPS, and he seemed highly committed. And just personally, we're keenly aware of the issue of beach erosion, which is what his company was to deal with, because it's a perennial issue along the entire New Jersey shore points where, near where we live. So from out where we were, EPS seemed like a business headed for a bullseye. Then in December of 2008, our initial investment in the Haverhill, Massachusetts project was about to close out. Since things had been going so smoothly, we decided to roll this over into a new investment. After looking through the opportunities and getting a couple of backup packages that were provided by FRM, we agreed to roll over our personal money, both of our IRAs, plus an additional $50,000 in personal money, an additional $13,000 from my IRA, and an additional $5,000 from my wife's IRA, into what we thought would become the 2009 Bel Air Trust, Miroslav Spoilov trustee in Holbrook, Massachusetts. This was closed in January 2009. The total was supposedly $200,000. You have in our documents copies of a series of letters from Diane Smith at CLNM, plus statements from our Pensco IRAs confirming and reviewing all of this. Now, at this point, two personal life situations intervened. I had a sudden health issue come up, and my mother, who had already been in declining health, was hospitalized. As a result, I was forced to take my eye off the ball for a time. Several months later, after the dust settled on my personal issues, another FRM opportunity came along in April 2009. This was the Pascalino, Northern Massachusetts bridge deal for $60,000. You'll find a letter from CLNM confirming this. By June 2009, this had still not closed. Now, around this time, I also came to realize that in the midst of my personal life chaos in the winter, I had never received closing paperwork on Holbrook, Bel Air, Spoilov deal. So I began calling about both of these open ends, and I was told at first that there was, I'm not really clear on this, but some kind of issue or problem or something because these two deals closed in Massachusetts, and there was some that created some issue. I'm not sure what it was. And then I was subsequently told that there was a title issue, and then that there was a health issue with one of the participants who wasn't available to be in closing because they were in the hospital. And you should have a copy of a July 9th letter from CLNM saying that the closing should happen the next week, and paying interest from the time our check was received in April until then. Now, in late June, early July of 2009, Scott Farris said that the Holbrook Spoilov deal would be closing out in August. So one deal with questions was going to be closing within days, and another deal with questions was ending, making money available again, and making questions go away. That seemed like good news at the time, but obviously I now realize it's just as Scott Farris wanted it to be. This is the clarity of hindsight. He asked if we wanted to roll our money into something else. Mollified by the apparent good news, and frankly lulled by receiving interest payments on all of our loans on time for a full 2 years, we looked at various new opportunities that were available at that time. We chose one with a Peter von Braun in Connecticut, and one with a Lon Montgomery in Idaho. I spoke with Mr. von Braun and confirmed some of the details of the package that he had submitted, and he made a generally believable and professional impression. So we decided to split our funds between these two deals and add some additional new money. You can see details of both of these in the CLNM letter dated September 28, 2009, and in our two-page summary of our loans. Unfortunately, we have no evidence that either of these closed in the 6 weeks between the CLNM letter and the day in November when FRM and CLNM stopped operating. Now, there are actually three interesting after-the-fact discoveries that I made about the Holbrook Bel Air Spoilov situation. In early 2010, I learned that there was a Massachusetts database available online through which one could see property records. When I checked the property in question, 29 Bel Air Drive, I saw that my position apparently was never recorded. The recorded mortgage holders were members of the Bean family. Second, in the first of these hearings that we're having today, earlier this week, I think it was, I heard something, the testimony of Mrs. Fallon, which I wasn't expecting to hear so fast very quickly, but sounded like they at one point also had a $93,000 claim on the same property. Thirdly, earlier this year, the bankruptcy trustee was listing in court documents the list of all of the trusts that were involved in the bankruptcy situation. And I noticed that our 2009 Bel Air Trust, Miroslav Stoilov trustee, was not included. I've still not been able to find out why. By November 2009, most of our funds, including our IRAs, were involved in a number of private lending instruments through FRM and CLNM. This includes $127,000 spent in August and September of 2009, which was to be added to the $200,000 that was being rolled over and coming out of the whole spoiler loan. When we learned of the closings of FRM and CLNM and the emerging details of what was behind the closings, we began making calls. I spoke with Mr. Clemmer at Earth Protection Systems. He had heard of the situation, and he said he felt he had been used, and he was having difficulty coming to terms with how this could have been done by the Farah family, with whom he had a decades-long relationship. I spoke with Mr. Von Braun again. He was absolutely stunned. He hadn't heard about it yet, and he said that in the June-July period, after he submitted all the documents supporting his request for funding and answered some follow-up questions from FRM, he was then given what the terms of his financing would be. He felt the terms were outrageous or something close to that, and he immediately withdrew his application. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have prevented FRM from using his documents to continue to solicit funds. I also spoke with Mr. Tracy in the Attorney General's office and Mr. Regan from the FBI. I spoke with Mr. Still, and then we exchanged emails, and I sent a set of 32 documents to him last December at his request. Now, looking back, in one part of our situation, we felt that given the hoops that IRA custodians like Pensco Trust put those on our end of the process through as we set up accounts, we had kind of assumed that they would be putting those receiving our self-directed funds through similar protected to the IRA holder hoops when funds were released. Apparently not. Now, those of us who have been testifying, I've heard a number of times, have been asked if we contacted any government agencies before lending through FRM. I understand the reason for the questions, and aside from the fact that the agencies weren't saying what they really knew, still really misses the bigger point, which is this. Government records released in the aftermath of the company's closing have shown that there were repeated multi-year violations for failures to comply with regulations and standards by these two companies. If there had been enforcement of the violations as they were found, I doubt the companies would have been around to ask about. What they were doing would have been discovered. If what audits and regulatory reviews showed had been public, we would have come across it. And if we had known FRM or CLNM had an issue, let alone a series of issues with government agencies, let alone that there was no enforcement behind these issues, we would never have begun lending through FRM. As my wife and I went through all this last November, it was as though a switch had been thrown. Our lives went from moving along in a modest and content way to being turned upside down and pulled inside out. We first went through weeks of sleepless night panic. We had lost almost everything. We began to realize that we needed to start doing things to make some major changes and hope we would be able to survive. Previously, we had been happy, feeling almost patriotic, that we did not need to apply for early Social Security benefits. That was no longer the case. We applied for the benefits, but it's still not quite enough to make our trip to the bone end. Having reached and passed retirement age, we now have to go back to looking for jobs in order to support the family. After searching unsuccessfully for 6 months for a full-time position, my wife took two part-time jobs. One has built to three-quarter time. I had a part-time job for 2 months, but was laid off in September. It's a humbling experience to be in one's 60s and ask one's mother-in-law for a short-term loan for survival. I had to do that. Now, both of us had been able to retire a bit early. We decided we wanted to devote much of our time to being parents, something we had not done in our younger years. We adopted a beautiful 3-month-old baby whom we named Amy. Our wonderful daughter is now 9 and a half. Now Amy sees her friends and classmates going places and being involved in activities that she's no longer able to do because we can no longer afford them. This has been difficult for us to live with. Now, as I understand it, there are still many who are lenders through FRM who have not come forward to testify. I know at least one person lost his home to foreclosure, and at least two others were forced to sell their homes to survive. Now, my point here is that I submit for your consideration what I think is that a lot of the people are coming forward to testify because their priorities have dramatically shifted through this process, and now they're spending their time getting from today to tomorrow to the next day. And so they're preoccupied with that. I think somewhere along the line, someone used the phrase something like acts of financial violence to describe what has happened to people from the FRM CLM situation. All we would add is that could and should have been prevented. Thank you for allowing us to have our story add texture to the stories of other families who have been so immeasurably wrenched and forever changed by this situation.
Mr. Hardy, thank you very much for your opening statement. I think I do have some fundamental questions about the multiple transactions that you had with FRM. In your dealings with FRM, did you speak directly with Scott Farah?
Yes.
And under what set of circumstances would you speak with him?
Well, initially it was just to get information about the company and what they were doing, and then after that it would be when an opportunity came along that we were interested in, and then he would send the full-blown package of background material on each deal.
As a result of receiving those packages, would you then call him to discuss anything?
Oh, yes.
And would you speak with Mr. Farah directly?
Yes.
Did you ever speak with the Donald Dodge?
Only once that I can recall.
Did you ever have dealings with CLM Inc.?
Regularly, yes.
And how would you characterize the dealings that you had with CLM Inc.?
Orderly, professional. It was monthly checks came, letters came confirming receipt of our checks. Any issues came up, there was a letter that came out, and whenever we called, it was phones were answered professionally, and we generally got a response to whatever the issue was we were calling about.
Is it fair to say that your view of CLM Inc. was that they were a loan servicing agent?
Absolutely, yes.
Is it fair to say that your view of FRM was that they were a broker for your lending?
With the proviso, I'm not sure what the full definition of broker is. They were bringing people together to do lending and borrowing.
It appears that some $472,000 was forwarded one way or another by you and your wife to FRM. Is that correct?
It is, yes.
Okay. Did you believe that funds provided by you to FRM were intended to be loaned to other entities for projects involving real estate?
Mostly, yes. Not in the case of Earth Protection Systems, but in the other cases, yes.
With the exception of Earth Protection Systems, did you believe that your loan was going to be secured by a mortgage for the breach of which you would have rights of foreclosure to protect your loan?
Absolutely, yes.
Any doubt in your mind about that?
No.
How about describing for me a little more clearly the Earth Protection Systems transaction with FRM?
Earth Protection Systems was based on the patent that Mr. Kleinert had developed to prevent communities having to continually replenish sand lost from beach erosion. And he had a patent on the device and was starting up, and he was needed to fit the model, needed cash flow to get the business moving and build it. And so it was FRM was collecting a pool of money, I don't remember the exact amount, it was like $2 million or so, to use in building this business based on security of purchase orders as the business got started. Once all the money was collected and the business was operating, then purchase orders leave the security behind it.
That was my next question. If real estate was not going to be the security for the earth protection system, what was your understanding of the security for your loan in that transaction?
If I understand your question correctly, it was once the full amount of what was being assembled had been collected and was then the business was then operating and making sales and had cash flow coming in, that then the security would be those purchase orders from their sales.
Do you recall any percentages being a component of that security interest on purchase orders?
Not without going back through paperwork. No, I don't remember.
If I suggested to you that it was 50%, would that refresh your recollection?
Not without going back.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I'm not going to ask you to go back because I believe we have testimony from other individuals in that area.
Okay.
At any time you forwarded money, either directly or authorized a rollover of monies with FRM, did you believe any of the monies were intended to pay for any component of the operation of FRM or CL&M Inc.?
Only to the extent that they might have a couple of points at a closing for doing whatever they were doing, but not in terms of the daily operating costs. No.
Did you feel at any time you were acquiring any business interest rights in FRM or CL&M Inc.?
No.
In your outline submittal that went to the Bureau, in the totaling of the sums forwarded to FRM, you use the word investments. Is it fair to say that all of those sums would be characterized as loans?
Yes.
Loans in all cases but one secured by a mortgage on real estate. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the one that was not secured by real estate was, in your mind, secured by purchase orders?
Correct.
Can you tell me how you initially physically forwarded money to FRM?
Through mail or FedEx.
Did you write a check?
Yes, in fact, among the 32 documents that I submitted to Mr. Still last December were photocopies of all of those checks.
So these were handwritten checks from you that were forwarded by U.S. Mail to FRM, is that correct?
U.S. Mail or FedEx or UPS.
Okay. If you recall, how much time transpired between the transmittal of these checks and an actual closing?
It really varied. For example, in the case of the air protection system.
Let's see. Yeah, hang up and try it again. We're still on the record. We've been cut off. Mr. Harding, this is Mr. Chandler. I'm just reminding you, you're on the record.
Right.
The question was, how much time, if you recall, transpired between the transfer of a check by you and a closing with FRM?
It really, I remember it varied. For example, the first one in April was very quick. they were actually waiting for the closing to happen when we decided to invest. But then the one in Holbrook, the Stoyloff Bel Air, that our check was received in the end of December. I think it was about 3 weeks later when we were told it closed. But then some of the ones where they were pooling money, collecting money from a number of sources, that could be a more extended period, like with Earth Protection Systems and the one that was supposed to be in Greenwich, Connecticut. They would collect, you'd send money and they'd collect it, and you'd start earning interest from when they received it, but the closing wasn't necessarily going to happen within a couple of weeks. It may take them several months to get the full amount that they were trying to assemble.
So on some of those loans where there was participation, as I characterize it, there could be several months between the time you forwarded money and the time of closing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And during that time period, you would in fact be earning interest?
Yes.
Did you ever actually receive an interest check?
Monthly.
You did?
Yeah, for 2 years, yeah.
Do you recall on whom that check was written?
CLM in most cases. I mean, we have photocopies of the ones that they sent to our Pennsville account.
Okay. No, that's you've answered the question that I was looking for.
And we had the stubs from all the checks that we received every month and deposited.
Bear with me while I look at. On the Haverhill, Massachusetts loan, I believe that was your first loan with FRM, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Were you the sole lender on this loan?
No.
This was participation also?
Yes. It was aside from me and our two IRAs, there was one other participant.
Okay. And had there been a breach of mortgage covenants, you believe that you, along with the other participants, had some right to foreclose the security interest in the real estate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In the process leading up to the closing of the Haverhill loan, were you ever forwarded appraisals of that property?
Yes. In fact, the appraisal is among the documents we submitted in our package of material that you should have, maybe in the sealed section, I'm not sure.
I have it.
Okay.
What role did that appraisal play in your decision to participate in that loan in Haverhill, Massachusetts?
Well, this goes back over 3 years ago. I don't know that I could actually recreate the whole process and what role this or any other piece on its own played.
That's a fair answer. Let me ask a different question. As a result of seeing that appraisal, did you feel that there was a reasonable loan to value? Do you understand my question?
Yes, I do. I haven't read the appraisal in 3 years. I guess I must have, overall, the whole set of information we received must have been, plus any follow-up questions you may have asked, must have been satisfactory.
Okay. Of whom would you have asked a follow-up question?
Scott Barrett.
Okay. Bear with me. I'd like to focus now on the loan that is not secured by real estate. That's the Earth Protection Systems, Inc. loan.
Mm-hmm.
Did you receive regular interest payments on that loan? Is it fair to say that that loan would have commenced in October of 2008?
Well, our part of it is, I don't know about other people may have...
As to you.
Yes.
Okay. Did you receive interest payments until such time as the failure of FRM?
Yes.
How did you learn of the failure of FRM?
So many things happened so quickly that I don't remember the sequence of it. There were emails, there were phone calls, there was another thing. I started calling to ask some questions, and it was unusual to not get anybody answering the phone at FRM, so then I started doing the same thing at CLNM, and there was also no answer there. And so then I started trying calling around other people that I knew in the periphery of the situation, other lenders and things. And that's somewhere along the line there, I stumbled upon someone who had heard, and then all kinds of things started happening, you know, internet searches and newspaper reports and things.
Is it your testimony that you contacted Austin Klenert, the president of Earth Protection Systems, Inc., regarding the failure of FRM?
Yes.
And could you, for me, summarize that conversation?
As I remember it, which is kind of fuzzy because of when it was and what was going on at the time, he was... still working through it, still trying to figure out what had gone on and what was happening. And he said, as I said, he had felt used because apparently he was learning things that were done that he was not privy to having been done. And he felt such an affinity for his family that he had known for so long, and he was just, you know, sort of a confused state.
Do you recall in that conversation if he ever indicated to you that he never received the funds that had been purportedly loaned to him?
The first part of your question, yes.
Do you recall in that conversation whether he ever indicated he did not receive any funds that had been purportedly loaned to him?
Well, he had received some like transportation funds to go to meetings and things, but it was not $2 million, you know, it was a couple $100 for expenses. And that he was, it was something about he was surprised they had used any funds if they had been used, because he wasn't actually operating yet, you know, he hadn't started.
So did he indicate to you that he had not drawn on these funds?
Sorry to be so vague here, but my memory of it is that he needed some money for expenses to go to meetings, you know, civic meetings to try and promote the Earth Protection System process, and that he could get, you know, a couple $100 for gas and hotel room and things like that. But that's, you know, what was more like expense account kind of thing. My memory of what he said.
That's fine. That's fine. Mr. Spill?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Mr. Harding, thanks for joining us today. Jeff Spill from Bureau of Securities Regulation, State of New Hampshire. Just have a few questions for you, if I could.
Sure.
And thank you for the kind words at the outset. That is also appreciated. You, at the outset, you stated, I think it was Holbrook, that the closing was delayed and there were some reasons given to you about title issues and health issues. Who was it that was stating those reasons, if you will, for the delay?
Well, one of the times it was Scott Farah, and then another time I was talking with Diane Smith about it, and she didn't know, but she said she would find out. And so she's the one that called back and said that there was an issue with title, some kind of title issue that needed to be cleaned up before closing could happen.
Did you get the impression? I'm sorry? I'm sorry, I didn't let you finish. Go ahead.
This is the Norton, Massachusetts clothing that we're talking about. Now, both the Holbrook one and the Norton one, I was told that there were some issues because things happened in Massachusetts, and I'm very fuzzy on what those, if there were any more specific yet. But the thing about the title problem and the thing about the person being having a health issue and not being able to go to a closing, those were both related to the Norton delay and the Norton closing.
And did you get the impression when Diane Smith said she would get back to you that she would be checking with Scott Farah?
That was my impression, yeah.
And can you give me the approximate time frame?
That would have been somewhere between the middle of May and the end of June of 2009. And then her letter, July 9th, says that it's going to happen the following week.
And with respect to Earth Protection Systems and Von Braun, those matters, I believe you stated you got a check for interest before they were finalized, correct?
Yes, both cases.
Was that also the case with the other loans, Norton and Holbrook?
Assuming that they never really closed, yeah, because we were getting interest checks, and I was never able to get any evidence that they actually did close.
Okay, and so
in fact, the Holbrook one, doesn't seem to be in the group of trusts that are being looked at here for whatever reason.
Okay, so you had four deals in total, or five?
Well, let me see this. The six that we thought, but two of them may have never happened. Well, three of them may have never happened. Four of them may have never happened. So I don't know. Depends on how you want to define what deals we were involved in. We thought we were at six, although one had closed and one had closed out successfully, and the second one was about to close out successfully.
And I'm sorry.
It wasn't six at one time, all at the same time. It was over a period of time, there were six different deals.
Okay, and is it my understanding that in all these situations, you received pre-closing interest?
It looks like that more now than it did at the time. We didn't receive any pre-closing interest in the Haverhill situation. I didn't think we were receiving pre-closing information in the Holbrook situation, except for now, in retrospect, I was assuming that it had closed in January when I was told it closed, and when Petco's records showed that it closed, but I don't have any evidence that it ever really closed. I have no evidence that Norton closed, and we did receive interest there, and the Montgomery, Idaho, and the Von Braun in Connecticut were due to close after that September 28th letter, but I had no evidence that actually happened, and we did receive interest on both of those.
And do you know which lenders you consulted with prior to getting involved with Financial Resources?
What type of lenders?
You said that you had checked with some other lenders about Financial Resources. Do you know who they were?
Oh. yes, I knew, yes, it was Elizabeth, I think her name is, and Harry and Priscilla Dean, and Scott Caruth, I think his last name is, in Georgia. I can pull that out and be more accurate for you if you'd like me to.
What was the first name that you said?
Last name Gates. I think it was Elizabeth Gates. Yeah, Elizabeth Gates in Hammond, New Hampshire. Harry and Priscilla Dean in Guilford, and Scott Krauss in Norcross, Georgia.
And what was the year of the first deal that you became involved in?
2007.
I believe at the outset of your testimony you stated 2003 was when you started getting postcards?
I don't remember when we started. We started doing private mortgage lending in our area in 2003. And sometime between then and 2007 we started getting postcards. And I know we got more than two or three of them over the years before we did any investigation of the company. We would get like 2 a year, you know, every 6 months or so.
And when you did the private mortgage lending in your area, did you do that through a mortgage lender?
No. It was really more, because it was in our area, we were really more directly involved with the borrowers.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Forcier, do you have anything?
Just one quick question. Mr. Harding, Eric Forcier, New Hampshire Bureau of Securities Regulation. You said to me, I may have missed it. I missed the first 2 or 3 minutes of your testimony, but I was just curious if you could go back and tell us which government agencies you spoke to prior to lending, if you did speak to anybody, and which government agencies you spoke to post November 9th, 2009.
It's not a government agency. The only agency we spoke with directly was the New Hampshire Better Business Bureau. We did a lot of online research and library research through the government records that we could find, but we didn't actually talk to anybody. But at least two of the five people that we talked with as references had said that they had already done that, and they sounded very believable, so we felt comfortable not actually having to do that ourselves at that point. Afterwards, I spoke with Mr. Still, and then I also spoke with Mr. Regan of the FBI and Mr. Tracy of the Attorney General's Office, along with a couple of the borrowers that we had talked with, and many other lenders as we began to develop a network of people.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Harding, this is Mr. Chandler again. I have a follow-up to Attorney Forcier's question. When you did your online research, did you check a website for the New Hampshire Banking Commission, if you recall?
I can't really recall. We were looking for whatever information we could find, and we went to various places in the New Hampshire government, but I'm not sure. I could not give you a list of which ones we did.
Do you remember doing a Google search for FRM or some equivalent of that?
Yes.
Okay. And you didn't find any connection to the New Hampshire Banking Commission from that search?
I don't really recall specifically that.
And this would have been prior to...
Was there something there that I would have come across if I had?
Well, it's not for me to testify at this point, but no.
I'm sorry.
Clearly, whatever research you did online was done prior to July the 13th of 2007, correct?
Yes, it was.
It would have been done subsequent to May of 2006?
Probably, yeah. I don't think it would... Yeah, it would have been earlier in 2007, not as early as 2006.
That's very important to me. You sure of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we would know. Not if we were going to act on something, we would have been doing it around the time we were going to act on it, or you know, building up to that. Now, I have a, but It would probably have been in the May, June area to get part of our documentation. You have a letter from Scott Barrett to me dated June 22nd, 2007, and that was a follow-up to one of the initial conversations I had with him. So the period immediately preceding that would most likely have been the time in which we were doing all of this research. Otherwise, I wouldn't have called him. And, you know, so it would have been the April, May, June 2007 period.
Is it fair to say that as someone who's been involved in private lending and did some due diligence as a result of conversations with Scott Farrow, you became comfortable with the opportunities that he presented to you?
Yes.
And your comfort was at least in part derived from the fact that all of your loans, with the exception of Earth Protection Systems, was going to be secured by an interest in real estate. Is that correct?
Among other reasons. There were lots of reasons that were building confidence, but yeah, that was certainly among them.
Okay. What were some of the other reasons that confidence was built?
That the interest payments were coming regularly, that everybody we had talked with was having the same kind of experience we were, that we were finding no red flags. You know, we're getting complete, I mean, the monthly kind of records that would come with the checks seemed very... Everything seemed to be going the way you would want it to go.
Okay.
But part of what I was really indicating there is that other people who were also lenders with whom we had become acquainted were having the same kind of experiences that we were, and over an extended period of time, over more than a year, as we got to meet more people, it reinforcing things.
Okay. Mr. Harding, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to put together your documents and taking the time to be available today to testify by telephone. I will be reviewing these documents. If I have additional questions for you, I will contact you through the Bureau. Do you have anything else you'd like to present to the hearing this afternoon?
No, I just want to say once again, thank you very much to you and your colleagues for what you're doing.
Thank you.
You bet.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Can I put that into exhibit?
Yeah. Oh, remember. That's you. Yeah. I'll do it like that. Good girl.
I'd like to call up the next gentleman, which is Mark Nolan.
Please, the next witness is going to be Mark Nolan. Mark Nolan.
Yes, it is.
Mr. Nolan, my name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer in a hearing here in the state of New Hampshire called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State regarding the FRM matter. Are you aware that you are on a speakerphone in a public hearing and that if you choose to testify this afternoon, you will be under oath?
Yes.
Okay. Do you choose to testify?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to ask you if you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, I will.
Okay. Mr. Nolan, for 2 weeks now we've been listening to testimony from victims in the FRM matter. Many of the victims have prepared opening statements, which they have read into the record. Others have made non-prepared opening statements. Do you have a prepared statement that you would read?
Non-prepared.
Would you like to make an opening statement?
Basically that, you know, through hindsight, looking at all the things that have gone, I am the victim from 2007, I took out my first mortgages or construction loans, and at hindsight, I see what had gone wrong and where things were going wrong, and with the mortgages, stalling of disbursements, waiting to the last minute to apply for conventional mortgages, basically that is it. I mean, I got backed into corners a couple of times and was forced to take money, more money than I wanted. Basically that's it. I mean, and the last time I was refinancing, my house was complete. I was just wanted a conventional mortgage. We got pushed into getting another or refinance through them. It was a regular mortgage. And even at that point, that was only supposed to be a year mortgage, but we even went past the deadline on that due to the CLNM and FMN trying to get us a mortgage. And then when we finally said to ourselves, why don't we just go out on our own and try to get a mortgage, went to two local banks, and we were able to secure a conventional mortgage. And our house had been appraised, overappraised for what they wanted to lend us, so I'm part of the McLevin lending. They were very kind, extending time to secure a mortgage, because we had gone several months past the maturity date. They worked with us to do so, and they still hold a small mortgage because the way the economy was and our house being overinflated and the appraisal from FRM, we finally were able to work with the local bank, and they agreed, the McClevins agreed to take a second mortgage on the property also, so that we could pay both of them down. Basically, that's it. I mean, there were plenty of times they held a disbursement for 4 months that we weren't able to, or we had to fund it ourselves with our own personal money. We were really struggling to, just to get the power in. They wouldn't even release any money. And we built the house that was on a slab, so a lot of the mechanics and everything were all up front. So we did have a higher amount in the beginning, and trying to finish up, we weren't able to get the money we needed. I guess that's about it.
Okay. I have a few questions I'd like to ask. I notice on many of the documents, for instance, a $95,000 promissory note and commercial loan is from Maria M. Bombard.
Yes, that's my other half. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
The names are Maria's and mine's in there, here and there.
Okay, but when you speak today, is it fair to say that you are speaking with full knowledge of transactions that show Maria M. Bombard as a borrower?
Yes, I'm speaking for Maria's behalf also.
Okay, and you have full knowledge of those transactions, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Everything was done with the two of us.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that, but I would like to just need to have that reiterated for the record. How did you become aware of FRM?
We first went to a company named First Aid Cottage. They're in New Hampshire. They have a kind of a kit home, but it's not that, is a post and beam type house. and we were referred to a fella that referred us to them for mortgaging for construction loan.
So is it fair to say that you went to FRM to borrow funds to construct your home?
Correct.
And who did you meet with at FRM, if anyone?
Tom McNeil, I believe the name was. And that was another part that you noticed that I have a $45,000 mortgage. For one, in the beginning, my understanding was it was going to be one mortgage. And then I even brought that up at the closing. I said, well, what is this? Already stocked me with double closing costs. And that was my first step.
Is it fair to say that your first loan was, in fact, the $95,000 loan involving Southwest Federated North Texas?
That one and the $45,000 were generated at the same time.
Did you get an explanation as to why there were two mortgage instruments?
Well, they said that it was easier to handle because they would put the $45,000 for the loan for the property. And then the proceeds went into a escrow with the $95,000.
Did you attend the closing?
Yes, we did.
Where was the closing held?
In Meredith.
At the offices of FRM?
Yes.
Were there attorneys present at that?
Just the legal secretary.
Are you familiar with the law firm Gould & Burke?
Yes, they're the ones that did the paperwork, the document.
I notice on your closing statement that you purchased title insurance from Gould & Burke for a sum of $1,000.
Well, I was not aware of that. I mean, at the time, I don't know why we needed that.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to stand corrected. You purchased title insurance for the sum of $215.
I noted on the one closing there of the $45,000 closing cost seems fair, but on the $95,000, I mean, the Goldenberg is charged like $15,000 and $500.
Did you feel that Gould & Burke was representing your interests at that transaction?
I'm going to have to say no. I guess we just got caught off because we were just trying to build our dream and that we're happy that we got a mortgage. And I did bring it up at the closing, what was the reasoning for the two mortgages, and to have the extra closing costs.
Did anybody at that first closing where these two mortgages were present advise you that you had an opportunity and a right to have legal counsel of your own to review documents?
I don't recall.
Okay.
But I do know aware of that, just from other closings in my history. But I just know how the banks work now. I just figured it was a regular financial institution that was honest, and I didn't have any extra parts. Our financial situation isn't. Before I was able to afford an attorney to review things, so I just took it upon the trust of them to represent me properly.
Did Maria Bombard then borrow an additional $45,000 through FRM?
No.
There's only one $45,000 transaction, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Next, I notice a promissory note from you and Maria Bombard to Alan K. McElvain and Susan K. McElvain, trustees of the McElvain Living Trust. Was that arranged through FRM?
Yes.
Did you attend that closing?
Yes, I did.
What's the status of that loan?
That's been closed off, though.
Okay.
That our house was completed. We had the certificate of occupancy. We had prepared to have a conventional mortgage in well advance of the maturity date of the 95 and the 45. It came way into July as a maturity on the other two were May. And they all of a sudden, CLNM said that Southwest and Financial were demanding their money, and we had to close within a week.
When did that occur?
That occurred like the beginning of July, or middle of July.
In 2008?
Oh, 2008, yeah.
And
the
that's...
The first mortgages were 2007.
So within a week of that oral demand from FRM, you closed with the Alan K. McElvain and Susan K., trustees of the McElvain Living Trust, you closed that loan?
Correct.
And that was arranged through FRM?
Yes.
And proceeds of that closing paid off the SMM 2007 Realty Trust, Dodge Financial Inc. trustee, and the Southwest Federated North Texas. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Do you now have a conventional loan from Lake Sunapee Bank on this property?
Yes, I do.
And do you also have, and that's secured by a mortgage, obviously.
Yeah.
And you also testified you have a mortgage with McElvain's. Is that correct?
Yes, they have secured a second mortgage for me.
Did FRM play any role in your financial relationship with Lake Sunapee Bank?
No. In July or June of 2009, the maturity date of McElvain's mortgage was coming up. I still wasn't secured with a mortgage from FRM and CLNM. So I started doing a little legwork of my own, and I applied to two local banks, Laconia and Lake Sunapee. I was denied at Laconia, but Lake Sunapee was willing to work with me. And within a short period of time, I think it was within 60 days, I had a conventional mortgage. And they even, the house appraised out at only 165, I believe. So Lake Sunapee would only lend, of course, only 80%. So they lent me $132,000, and then the McLevin Trust, Alan and Susan, agreed to take a second mortgage for $23,000, and that was all between them and us.
Okay, so the
FRM or CLNM had nothing to do with it.
They played no role in that. In your final mortgage relationships, is that correct?
Correct. I mean, we just got fed up because they weren't able to get us anything, so Maria and I went out on our own locally and tried to secure a loan, and we did it within, you know, two tries. Whereas CLNM and FRM were, you know, they kept telling us, you know, we have someone. They, you know, we were having appraisals left and right. nothing came about them.
Did you ever see appraisals presented to you from FRM?
Yes, we did see.
If you recall, were the appraisals substantially higher, lower, or about the same as the appraisal you saw with Lake Sunapee Bank?
Substantially higher.
Do you recall any numbers?
That's part of the reason why they did the 155 originally, because they appraised the house out at $250,000. And with Laconia, it was $195,000. And with Lake Sunapee, a whole nother 4 or 5 months, or 3 months went by, and it went down to $165,000.
Do you recognize the name Gould & Burke as a law firm?
Yes.
Do you feel that at any time they represented your interests?
In hindsight, no. I mean, I was naive at the time, I guess.
At the time of the closings, did you feel that you were being represented by Gould & Burke?
Partially.
Did anybody...
That's what they said, I guess. I mean, I believe they did mention that.
Did Lake Sunapee Bank tell you that in order to secure a mortgage from them, you would be obligated to purchase owner's and lender's title insurance?
I believe so. I mean, I do believe we purchased that.
I'm looking at your HUD closing statement, and it appears that you did purchase title insurance at what's called a reissue rate.
Okay.
Do you understand what a reissue rate is?
No.
Okay. Well, I do, so that's okay.
I'm assuming because we already had it 3 other times.
So the proceeds from the Lake Sunapee closing fundamentally went to McIlvain's to pay down to the greatest extent possible your existing mortgage secured through FRM. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And a portion was left, and the McIlvain's financed you as a second mortgage to finish your financial obligation with them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Are both of those loans performing today?
Yes, they are.
Bear with me for a minute. Have you had any contact from a trustee in bankruptcy? Have you had any contact from an attorney Nottinger?
Yes.
You have?
I believe that is Alan and Susan's attorney.
Do you recall what the substance of that contact was?
Mainly just to tell us where we're supposed to make our payments to.
Well,
I believe that.
If I suggested to you that you received a communication telling you to make a payment to someone other than the McIlvain's, would that refresh your recollection?
I
Let me ask it a different way.
Well, we make it to a... Maria makes it to a...
Let me ask that a different way. Are you still making payments on the second mortgage to the McIlvains?
Yes, yes. Well, not today. It goes to an escrow account that an attorney's holding. I just can't recall the name. Nottinger does sound like it.
Okay. And those payments are pursuant to a promissory note dated March 19, 2010. Is that correct?
Correct.
Made by you, Mark W. Nolan, and Maria M. Bombard, correct?
Correct.
If I suggested to you, well, strike that. I have nothing further. Mr. Spill, do you have any questions?
I do, sir. Thank you. Mr. Nolan, thanks for joining us today. Jeff Spill, State of New Hampshire, Bureau of Securities Regulation. I just have a few questions for you, if I might. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
The Southwest Federated North Texas firm, can you tell us who you dealt with for that loan?
I believe the fellow's name is Tom McNeil.
Does the name Chad Vose ring a bell to you?
No. No, it doesn't. No.
Okay, and with respect to the loan from the McIlvains, the McIlvain Trust, do you recall who you made the payments to?
I believe CLNM. We had a booklet from CLNM.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
We had a booklet from CLNM, I believe.
Okay, and at the time you were making those payments, was your house completed?
Yes.
And you were living in the house?
Yes.
And that was your primary residence?
Yes. Yeah, we closed on it prior to the maturity date of the Southwest and, or not, I didn't just mean closed on, we had the certificate of occupancy and it was the house was complete prior to the maturity of the Southwest and the Dodge DMN.
When was the house complete? Can you give me the time frame?
April 27th was the name that came out of 2008. Yeah. They issued the certificate of occupancy on May 1st, 2008.
I have no further questions, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
Attorney Foster.
No questions.
I have nothing further, Mr. Nolan. Is there anything else you'd like to present to the hearing today?
No, I think we're good.
I want to thank you very much for, one, taking the time to assemble documents for us, and two, taking the time to testify today. I'm sure it would be helpful. If I have additional questions as the hearing proceeds, I may call you again, but that would be through the Securities Bureau.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're good, thank you.
So I want this
to be exhibit 31.
31, all of it's under seal.
Okay.
Ed Harding, okay. And
Mrs. Ollier and Harding's testimony, is that correct?
Yeah, the documents associated with it, his testimony is here, and this would be Mark Dolan, that's not good. Okay?
32.
Yeah. For the record, we're not holding hearings Monday the 15th. So the next time we will return will be Wednesday the 17th at 10 a.m. Are there any other matters at this time, either Mr. Spill or Mr. Forcier?
No, sir.
No, sir.
Okay. With that, I'm going to adjourn the hearing.
Thank you.